This is Abby, and you are listening to Upzoned. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of Upzone, a show where we take a big story from the news each week that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Abby Newsham, a planner in Kansas City, and joined with me today is my friend Chuck Marone, author and founder of Strong Towns. Hello, Chuck. Welcome.
Hey, Abby.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. You know, it's actually... We got some like weird snow thing that came in last week. So we had, you know, like a foot of snow on Easter. It was kind of crazy. Didn't fall on Easter, fell the week before Easter, but it was kind of nuts. And now it's going to be 60 degrees and it's all gone away and we might actually get spring. So we'll see.
Well, spring is full steam ahead here in Kansas City. I'm like, and I love that we're talking about the weather. It's very on brand for us. But
that's right.
Yeah, I know. We're fully in spring now, which I'm very happy about. I don't know how you survive up north. I don't get it.
Well, March is the ugliest month of the year, and I'm happy that it's gone. April, things start to, you know, come back here and we'll see. Prince famously wrote the song, "It Sometimes Snows in April." And I think people thought it was a metaphor and no, he's just Minnesotan because sometimes it does snow in April. Yeah, no, of course it snows in April. Sometimes it snows in May, but, you know, we try not to think about that too much.
Yeah. May is where I draw the line. That's completely unacceptable. And you know what? We've been doing this for 4 years, if you can believe it. And when you said that it was snowing on Easter, I actually had kind of a moment of deja vu. I think you've said that before and maybe more than once. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, probably. I think this year the contrast was, I mean, we had no snow on Christmas. We had no snow in January, February. So it's been a horrible winter in Minnesota because we embrace snow and cold and we just haven't had it. We've had basically like 4 months of March. And now that it is March and you're getting to Easter and you're like, all right, let's start greening up. Let's start making this nice. We get a foot plus of snow. Yeah. I mean, this has been Snow Talk with Abby and Chuck.
Yeah, snow talk. It's better than UFO talk, I think.
Well, but I don't know about that.
Oh, we could get to that too. Okay, so today we are talking about Colorado, which I'm very excited. I actually, when I was reading this article, I was wondering if Strong Towns has ever written about the I-70 debacle, and I was surprised that I couldn't find anything. So I'm kind of excited to touch on it now because it's something that I think a lot of people are aware of if they've ever been to Denver or are engaged in ski snowboarding culture at all. So this article is published in Outside Magazine by Gloria Liu. It is entitled "Colorado's I-70 Has America's Most Notorious Ski Traffic. Is There a Solution?" So as a Kansas Cityan, this is a subject that I'm pretty well aware of because a lot of people from Kansas City take pretty frequent trips to Colorado to go skiing and snowboarding. Denver is actually the next major city that is westward of us. It's, you know, albeit an 8-9 hour drive, it is the next major city along the I-70
route. I don't think it has to take 8 or 9 hours, Abby.
Well, for you,
Do you remember the time that I did?
Yeah, you've done that drive and you did it. Why do you want to tell that story?
Well, just very briefly, I overslept. I mean, I have not really screwed up many things in terms of timing as in my time with doing this with Strong Towns, but I did. You and I were out late with Joe. I got to say, I don't drink. I was not drinking. It was just like fun, frivolity, talking. We were just chatting up the night. I went to bed and I like at probably like 1 or 1:30, and I had to get up at 4:30 or 5 to get on a plane. And when I woke up, I'm like, wow, I feel really refreshed for not getting any sleep. And that was because I'd overslept by like an hour. So then I was supposed to go to the airport and get on a flight to Denver. And I wound up I got up, didn't even take my pajamas off, just ran out to the car, threw my bag in the car, and just started driving west. And yeah, I made it. But
good.
Yeah.
How long did it take you?
I don't recall, and I'm not going to surmise. I'm not going to suggest, but let me just acknowledge right now that I did not stick to the prescribed speed limit on it's I-70 across the great state of Kansas. I might have also brushed my teeth, changed clothes, and done other things while I was driving.
Sure, you did a phone call, hotel checkout, and
yeah, no, I did all those things.
Well, you had plenty of time to do it, although it sounds like you didn't have as much time as other people have when they're on that drive. It's a pretty brutal drive. It's like, I mean, between Kansas City and Hays, Kansas, you go through the Flint Hills and it's pretty nice. And then the other half of Kansas is like very flat. And at first, whenever I do it, it's like a couple hours into that, it's kind of neat. Like it's just this vast open nothingness. But then you get into like several hours of that. And I tend to feel like I'm going crazy. And you hit the Colorado sign thinking that you're going to see mountains soon. But Denver is like in the middle of Colorado. So you have to keep going, and you're slowly going up, but it just looks like Kansas basically. So
whenever I've done it, and I've done it a few times, I always think of the settlers heading across on wagon train.
Totally. Yeah.
Just the sheer, like the thing is like at some point you would have been like, just give me something else. Just give me the mountains. Like, where are they? And then once you got to the mountains, you had to have been like, what were we thinking, that this would be fun?
I could totally see why people would have gotten there and said, I think I'm just going to stay in Denver. I'm fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Never mind.
Right. Right.
I've thought about that as well. I'm sure a lot of people have had that thought. Like you hit the mountains and it's like, it's so incredibly, the contrast is amazing.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It is a massive contrast.
It's very daunting.
You are rising the entire time. So, I mean, if you look at a topography map, it does, you know, there is in a sense elevation change, but it's so subtle, and then contrasted with the massive uplift of the Rockies. You can see why people stopped at Denver. It's like, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah. Okay. So for anybody who isn't familiar with I-70, so when you hit Denver and I-70 continues to go west, it's basically the only way to get to all of the different ski resorts from the city of Denver. It's not technically the only way, but it is the primary and most direct route. Generally, this route has stayed the same basically since the 1970s, but the number of cars that are accessing it has jumped more than 500%. And this traffic is overwhelmingly concentrated on weekends and holidays during peak winter recreational seasons. And it's pretty well known by Coloradans that and frequent visitors that the I-70 gridlock is going to happen every weekend during ski season. If you want to get to the mountains during that time, you have to leave really early, like 3 a.m., 4 a.m. early. The author of this article, it's actually a really fun article if you get into it. She investigates this chaos and goes and, you know, actually gets herself into the traffic, interviews people who, you know, left at 3, 4 a.m. Then she interviews people who left a little bit later, and just out of curiosity of who are these people and you know, why are they planning the way that they're planning? And she's really attempting to answer many questions. What causes I-70 traffic? Could it be fixed? And basically, how did traffic on I-70 and other famous recreational arteries reveal about our general relationship with nature in the United States, which I think is the most interesting and profound insight about this article. One thing that I'll mention that I think was kind of funny is that when I was reading this article, I pulled up Google Maps and wanted to go on Street View and see what it looks like. And it was kind of funny because the streetcar vehicle can never be found in the months of December, January, February, or March. So it sounds like Google Street Map knows not to bring that car into the mountains during those times because traffic looks completely fine if you just look at it on Street View.
Sure, sure.
So, Chuck, you've been in this traffic before, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, quite a few times.
And what are your thoughts on it? Do you think that there is a way to fix this?
The premise I find interesting because what do we mean by fix? You have this problem really everywhere. And I was thinking about like, where have they actually dealt with this? And I'm going to give you an example of where they've dealt with this. But let me give you some of the places where we struggle with it. Yellowstone Park, to me, is like one of the prime places. You can get in there and there's a little bit of congestion at peak periods getting in. But once you're there, it's like, it's crazy. As someone who has gone to Yellowstone a number of times, I'll say that the automobiles are just destroying the experience. The number of people. And so, you know, think about what we're saying. I'm saying that this beautiful national park, this wonderful place where people love to go and love to see and love to be in nature, the fact that we're there makes it not nature anymore and actually kind of ruins it. So everybody else go away so I can have my nature. And it doesn't like work that way. Right. So the interesting thing about the I-70 problem up into the mountains is that if you break it down and you say, well, let's fix the traffic problem. And I mean, one of the classic ways that you fix, you know, you and I would think this is dumb, but I'll say one of the pushes here is to add more capacity to the highway. How do we get more lanes built? How do we get the Eisenhower Tunnel widened? How do we switch this traffic so that we use more lanes in each direction? So in other words, if we're going to have 8 lanes, can we use 6 lanes going to the mountains on Friday and 6 lanes coming back from the mountains on Sunday? You know, are there ways to engineer this to just work better? And let's pretend that we could actually do that. Let's pretend that somehow that actually worked. What would you do with all the cars once you got them there? I mean, I remember being in Vail 20 years ago, getting a tour as part of a American Planning Association conference. And 20 years ago, so in the early 2000s, they were selling parking spots in a ramp for $125,000 a piece. I don't know what that would be today. I mean, double that, triple that, it would be insane. It's not like you've got a lot of place to park twice as many cars. Okay, let's pretend that you could park twice as many cars. Where are you going to put all these people? What mountains are they going to ski down? I mean, you're talking about basically like transforming an experience that is kind of by its definition, a rugged, exclusive kind of experience into something that is more mass marketed. And I don't see how it's a little bit like just the geometry of the physics of doing this, of moving this many people, just physically like doesn't work.
Let's talk about what you just said there, that you described this as both rugged and exclusive, which I think that's a really interesting juxtaposition because it really gets to this idea of our relationship generally with nature. Because when you're talking about Yellowstone, I had the same experience with the Grand Canyon, where you essentially have this like bottleneck and everybody's trying to get to the same destination. And I think about, you know, car commercials even. I mean, car commercials often feature the great outdoors, and we have this very Americanized relationship between the outdoors and really a fundamentally car-centric society. And to get from Denver to the mountains, you really do need a car to conveniently do that and to get into the wilderness and experience it really with all of these different destinations. So, and really all of these sports are very expensive as well. But I think that from a marketing perspective, all of this is pitched as kind of this like rugged individualism. And, you know, you're going out and camping and fishing and hiking. But it's a lot of these places are really not very rugged. A lot of them are, you know, have been built around this idea of exclusivity and resorts. I mean, that that seems to be just the way that we have marketed and packaged our entire relationship with nature.
There's a certain trade-off I think you make with nature, and it is in some ways like incompatible with kind of the American ethic of equal access and equal opportunity and all that. I'll look at like the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area here in Minnesota, because we have a lot of this tension here and a lot of this discussion here. And let me preface this by saying, my dad is disabled. My father had polio when he was a kid. He's had a couple dozen surgeries on his legs. He's never been able to walk well. I've grown up with that my entire life. So I don't say this from a standpoint of not having compassion for people who struggle. But if we look at like the wilderness area we have here in the northern part of Minnesota, it is not accessible to people in wheelchairs. It's just not. If you are going to go to the Boundary Waters, you have to carry your canoe. You have to carry a pack. You have to hike trails that are not well-maintained. They can't be well-maintained because they're literally back in the wilderness. You have to climb over down trees. You have to climb up steep rocks. It is very rugged. And the trade-off you get is that the more you are, in a sense, willing to do that, the more you get close to nature, the more you get away from everybody else. The pushback on this from an American standpoint, I'll point to my dad, because I've had this conversation a number of times with my dad. My dad has said, like, I would love to see this. Like, I would love to experience this. I would love to be part of this. And I understand that. Like, I get that. That is a very human thing, and it's a very beautiful thing. But in order to make it so that my father can experience that, you basically have to, I'm not going to say go as far as like to pave the trails, but you're going to have to make it like very easy for someone to get in. Right now, you can't bring motors into the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. There's been talk about letting people who are disabled be able to use motors, be able to use motorized access, all this. I'll just say, I think it's right for people to want that. I think it's beautiful for people to want that. But the more accessible you make all these places, the less they are actually the nature that you're trying to go and be in. And there is a certain trade-off between, when I say exclusivity, I don't mean rich. I mean, there's a certain amount, you know, you get your lottery pick to go in at a certain access point on the Boundary Waters. And if you're willing to spend 2 days rugging a pack deep in, you're going to experience as close to authentic nature as anyone ever will, in 2024. If we had as our highest priority making that very accessible to people, that ability to experience something would go away. I'm not necessarily like advocating for that trade-off. Like I struggle with that trade-off too. Like I get it, because there would be nothing more enjoyable than bringing my dad to be able to see. I mean, he wouldn't today. He's older now, but I mean, 20 years ago, would he have loved to have gone? Yeah. I mean, he absolutely would have loved to have gone. There would have been something beautiful about bringing him, but I recognize that if I could have brought him there, it would not have been there that he would have been going to see, right? It would have been a very different place. So when you look at something like Yellowstone or I-70, what you're looking at is places that we've made like very accessible for like very, I think, decent human reasons often. There's also commercial reasons, but you know, let's look at the decent human ones. But that human presence is incompatible with the actual space you're trying to get people to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting that we were thinking about exclusivity in different ways, because I think the heightened accessibility is what turns the idea of exclusivity into more of an economic one rather than a physical or one that's about effort, because the marketing brochure is that this idea of exclusivity is about being rugged and, you know, adventurous and being the one to be able to, you know, be tough and rugged and go out into the mountains. And that's really the way that I think a lot of Americans think about the West and the mountains. and how we interact with them. And we've made it really easy to access these places. And that's why you now have, you know, places like Vail and all of these kind of very exclusive ski towns that I think still sell this concept of being rugged and having a relationship with the outdoors. Although, you know, really the barrier to entry to get to these places tends to be more of a financial one rather than one of, you know, roughing it or, you know, being adventurous and taking a lot of effort to get there. So I think that's kind of shifted. The author of this article went into kind of the history of the tourism economy generally and how that works with kind of the mountains and the outdoors. World War II seems to always be the turning point for the United States when all of these things happened. And I'm sure that won't surprise you because that's when Colorado's tourism economy really began. She talks about how post-World War II, there was this economic shift towards the utilization of the outdoors for recreational purposes. I-70 was actually supposed to terminate at Denver. And there was an aggressive lobbying campaign that enabled the construction of the route to go through the mountains. And the approval came in the late 1950s. So as the highway construction happened, it was happening at the same time that we were enabling the suburbanization of our cities and building highways outside of metropolitan areas, increasing land values, and enabling people to access more places with greater ease. The same thing essentially happened with the mountains. All of these towns were really vying to be the ones that could connect to I-70 and get that access at the time that they were planning and constructing this route all the way through Colorado. And that opened up a really significant investment opportunity for all of these towns that were along this route. And the Eisenhower Tunnel was completed in 1973 and just basically exploded the tourism industry and created this dynamic that we now see today.
It's interesting to me because I think what you're describing and what you're seeing is not only the failure of the auto-based model to, in a sense, accommodate growth beyond a certain point. I mean, the auto-based model allows you to grow very quickly, but at a kind of denuded way, right? It's a quantity over quality kind of trade-off. You can get growth really, really, really quick, but it's not going to be productive growth. We see the same kind of dynamic in the I-70 corridor, and we see the same kind of dynamic at every place where we've created these kind of great places or we have these great places that we're trying to access here in North America. I hesitate to talk about Europe because I know there's a lot of people who are like, yeah, we're not Europe.
And Chuck, I have Europe on my mind too. So I'm really excited that you just mentioned this.
I have been to the ski towns in Switzerland. I don't ski, so I'm not like a skiing person, but I have gone to like Zermatt where the Matterhorn is and done hiking in the mountains. I've been to Chamonix where the like 60s Winter Olympics were in France in the French Alps. These places are astounding. They're amazing. I mean, Zermatt, you literally can't drive to. You have to take a train. Like there's no other way. And just that very fact limits the number of people. It's like a throttle on the number of people that can go. And so you have to buy your ticket in advance. You have to do these things. But then you don't have the kind of same flooding of traffic dynamics that you have in other places, even though it's a very desirable place. The same thing with Chamonix. I mean, we took a train to get there. Once you're there, you walk everywhere. A car is really out of place. It doesn't really fit in. You've got great transit there. I mean, they've got buses there so you can get around. Are there people of modest means who are denied access to Zermatt and denied access to Chamonix? No, they're not. Do you get to go anytime you want on a whim? And, you know, enjoy? No, of course not. Like you have to, there's a trade-off, and the trade-off is you have to plan ahead. You have to coordinate. You have to make reservations. in some of these places, you have to enter into a lotto and you get, you know, your slot opens up, these kind of things. But the idea that you would somehow get everybody's car access and equal, you know, have lots of parking and accommodate all the strip development along the whole way. These are very American concepts that take the problem that you're experiencing with wanting to access these places and just, in a sense, like Americanizing the stupid part of it, like just taking the, all of the negatives of it and just really ramping them up to 100x. And you don't, I'm not saying you don't see that in other parts of the world, but you don't see it anywhere near the craziness that we have around cars and around the experience of like everybody driving there to enjoy this moment with nature. And the cost for doing that is 14 hours of just sheer like hatred of sitting in an automobile trying, you know, stuck in traffic trying to get there.
So can we talk about the relationship between Denver and the way that city is and these mountain destinations? Because so I'm going to Barcelona, Spain in a couple of weeks. And as part of that trip, I'm planning to go to something called Montserrat, which is about an hour outside of the city. It's a, you know, up in the mountains. It's an amazing destination that hopefully I'll be able to talk about when I get back. Obviously, I'm flying to Barcelona. I'm not going to have a car. It's a city where you don't need a car. I'll take trains, public transportation.
You wouldn't want a car.
I wouldn't want a car.
Right. Because I mean, you'd have to find a place to park it and all that. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. I've been looking at Google Maps and doesn't look like there's a lot of parking lots in Barcelona. Very different than Denver. And to get to Montserrat, my understanding is, I don't know how many people drive to this place. I don't know if you even can really drive to this place, but you can take a gondola, you can take a train, or you can hike it, which I've signed up to hike it, and we'll see how, if I'm kicking myself when I'm doing it. But those are basically, as I understand it, the ways to get to this place. Denver is a city where, I mean, whether you live there or you are a visitor, I can't imagine flying to Denver. Well, typically you drive to Denver from Kansas City, but you can fly to Denver and I can't imagine not renting a car and having a car to get around. If you were just visiting the metropolitan area of Denver, it is so spread out. It is incredibly car centric. And I mean, even in this article, the author, when she's doing her investigative reporting, she talks about these dino lots, which are basically large parking lots where people meet up in Golden, Colorado, right at the end of, or right at the beginning of the Front Range. And, you know, they consolidate things into one person's car and everybody takes one car up to the mountain. So, and that's a carpooling solution to this issue. The entire Denver metropolitan area is incredibly car centric. So the idea of having a train, I think it's a better approach to dealing with this issue, but it's almost as if that, how do you even get everybody in the Denver metropolitan area to be able to get to this one train stop that could take you into the mountains? It's like that creates a bottleneck in and of itself. So I think that there's like a fundamental relationship between these destinations and the way the cities that are next to them are planned and laid out and how they operate. Because if you're in Denver, you're going to have a car. And if you have a car, you may as well just drive to the mountains. And, you know, even getting people out of their cars and onto a train in that environment is very different than, you know, flying to Barcelona or, you know, a city where you are not going to have a car anyway, and then taking a mode of transportation where there's a general consensus that this is the way we do it.
So let me say this differently, because I feel like you are still wrestling with the problem and I'm,
you've given
I said
up.
You at the beginning, well, I said, are we really going to talk about this? Because what you're saying to me is that the development pattern in Denver is so dysfunctional and auto-oriented that the idea of dealing with this problem of I-70 really kind of reveals all the different things that would need to change with this deep dysfunction in order to solve this I-70 problem. And I actually look at it the other way. I look at it as I-70 is just the consequence. It's like the most acute pain that you experience from the deep dysfunction. We experience the pain like regularly in small ways, like chronic ways all the time living in the Denver area. But the place where it becomes acute is here. Like this is where it becomes like, oh, this is unbearable. But actually you bear it a little bit at a time every day living in the Denver area. I was in Denver a couple of weeks ago and I was like, I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus here, literally or metaphorically. I was speaking with some people who were in their 20s, the exact demographic to ride transit, ride the rail line that they have. They lived two blocks from a rail stop, and the one woman worked, again, a couple blocks from a rail stop at the other end. The ideal, like if you had said, who's the commuter shed here for taking this commuter rail line in, it would be this person that I was chatting with. And she drives every day. And the question was, why do you drive? And she goes, it's more convenient. I look at that and you can get mad. You can be angry. You can say that is a selfish thing to do or the wrong thing to do, or they built this rail line. Why don't you take it? It's, you know, but the reality is that her lived experience, her way of getting around in Denver, she finds it more convenient to own a car, get in a car, drive a car, park downtown, do that reverse at the end of the day. And whatever pain that that brings to her is less pain than the pain of riding the rail line. I can't solve that dysfunction. Like that is like eight levels of dysfunction piled on top of each other, of which I-70 is just like the most visible and gratuitously awful part of it. We may want to, because we're like really affluent as a country, say, let's pour tons and tons of money into building a train and building a, I saw once a plan for like an elevated skyway thing that would go through. There are all these things that like people want to do to get people up to the mountains. And I'm just like, a pox on all of you. Like sit in your damn congestion and bear it. Because like this is the world we've created, and the world we've created has some consequences. And if we want to not experience those consequences, you can't just like shoot up a drug and like get beyond it. You actually have to like do things differently. And I think that's the thing that bothers me the most, is because if we said, list the top 10 problems in the Denver metro area, this would not be one of my top 10. This is a symptom of a problem, but this is not a problem. This is actually like the symptom, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good point, because as the article talks about, and I think it was actually quoted from the Colorado Department of Transportation, that this problem is incredibly concentrated. It is concentrated on the weekends during ski season, and all other times traffic is not as much of an issue. And so this is something that is like you said, very acute, and it's focused during a particular time. And does it make sense to spend millions and millions and millions, billions of dollars to try to overlay new infrastructure on top of this problem for something that is really focused on ski season and people just trying to ski in the mountains? Maybe the rugged adventure part of this is getting into traffic.
I mean, okay, I said I would mention places that work. I mentioned some places in Europe, and I think there are places around the world like the Boundary Waters where we use lotteries and other things to kind of put a limit, like here's the carrying capacity of this place. But I'll give you the gratuitous capitalist model of this working. Go to Orlando and go to Disney World. Millions of people a year visit this place. A huge percentage of them come in their cars. And the very first thing they do when you arrive in your car is they get you out of your car. They get you out of your car in like a remote place away from everything. And they put you on transit and they bring you places. They put you on buses. They put you on trams. They put you on monorails. They put you on trains. and they bring you places and they make that part of the experience. Like, hey, I'm getting off here and I'm going here. It's part of the whole experience. But the reality is that the very first thing they do is they separate you from your car. And when they separate you from your car, now we can move massive amounts of people at speed, high volumes, high speed, somewhat luxuriously to different places. It works out really, really well. They make a gargantuan sum of money doing this. And it's fantastic. If I were trying to solve the I-70 problem, like you make me try to solve it. The first thing I do is I make one lane, a bus only lane. I put barricades up the whole thing so no one can go into it. And then I just run a gargantuan number of buses. I run 200 buses or 400 buses or 2,000 buses. I don't care what it is. And I just start them at a parking lot and I drive them up the mountain and I drive them back down. And I just do that over and over and over. And then I charge people for that. I mean, I charge them like obscene amounts of money to whatever the cost is for this bus. That's what I charge them. And I mean, to me, the idea that we would just all like impotently sit in traffic and be like, you know, all right, someone solve this for me. It is kind of the most mindlessly dumb American thing that I can imagine. You won't catch me being like an anti-American person. I've come from a small town. I am not one of these people who's like, America's so dumb. But there are things that like I'll speak about in the family, like, okay, this is really dumb. I-70 and the whole like escape to the mountains and then all of us sitting there looking at each other. I mean, the article had like, oh, they had bluegrass bands on the side of the road.
Yeah, so
here's
funny.
A guy taking a whiz in the woods. And like, I mean, we've created our own dysfunctional culture on top of this dysfunctional culture of driving up into the mountains. I mean, I don't know. I find it to be multiple layers of silliness.
What you just proposed, I think, would be the most functional way of dealing with it. I think it would give people an aneurysm in Colorado because it would be so different. But yeah, it's like, why don't you have everybody park in one place, use one lane for tons of shuttles to get people out into the mountains with all of their gear and everything that they need. And then, yeah, you have one lane that's reserved for trucking and emergency vehicles.
Would it be worse than what you've got today? I mean, I don't understand. We were there, I said, a couple of weeks ago. We didn't go up I-70. We went somewhere else, but we went somewhere else because I wasn't going to do I-70. If I go that route, I only go on times when like it's not this insanity. I am willing to like forego the experience of skiing on a weekend in Denver in order to not experience that.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've skied out there, but I think I would need to go on like a Wednesday through the weekend and make it a long weekend kind of thing to do because that sounds terrible. Yeah, horrible.
We have a meeting in 2 minutes, so I got to run.
Okay. But, let's skip the down zone this time and okay. I'll catch you next time.
Well, down zone next time. I keep bringing up Disney World because I think it's genius. If you go to Disney World, I know everybody, like if they ever go, it's like our one trip, yay. And like everyone's excited to go on Space Mountain or whatever. I like the transportation system. So like just take note of how the buses work and how the monorail works and how this, like how they get you out of your car and get you someplace else. And if you just take out the rides and put in homes and shops, it actually works the exact same. When I talk about Strodes and I talk about the difference between streets and roads, this literally came to me when I'm a 16-year-old at Disney World going, oh, this is why this works so well.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I could see the headline now. Strong Towns believes there's a lot that we can learn from Florida.
There like, is.
Yeah. There's just so much we can learn.
Just not outside of theme parks.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah,
few areas. There's a few areas. Florida is the Strode capital of the world, but there are a few areas that you can learn a ton from.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Abby.
Some good pockets. Thanks, Chuck. I will talk to you next time. And thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Upzoned. Talk to you later, Chuck.
Bye-bye. Let me show you what I'm about to do.
down tonight.